Sorry, sorry. Did I just make you choke on some ice? I did not mean to.
No. I have very long ice cubes at the moment because...
of the heat.
No, because I bought some trays that I thought would work as like single serving soup freezing. And they're too small for that, but they do make basically giant ice cube cuboids.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the very 108th episode of Octothorpe, a podcast for science fiction and science fiction fandom, which is coming to you on the 25th of April, 2024. I'm John Coxon.
I'm Alison Scott.
And I'm Liz Batty.
And we have some letters of comment.
In fact, we have a bumper mailbag due to not doing any letters of comment while you guys were on at EasterCon.
Yes.
We got some quick comments on Blue Sky. Nuala got Why Don't You Love Me out of the library, and I think we made them sad. I'm sorry. I hope you enjoyed it as well. But yeah, it's quite traumatising. And we also heard from Raj, who is recommending a place where John can go and get pizza crunch.
What's pizza crunch?
It came up. It's something I heard about on a podcast I listened to called Octothorpe. They had a recent episode at an EasterCon where they discussed it. But it is where you deep fry pizza.
Oh, so deep fry pizza has a name that's not just deep fried pizza?
Yes.
It's Pizza Crunch?
Yes.
Okay, I understand now. I'm a bit slow and I'm old, so it's hard for us to adopt new vocabulary. I'm looking forward to eating some Mars Bar Crunch when I'm in Glasgow.
Oh, I don't know if it's called Mars Bar, yeah.
I think it's only pizza.
It's not a specific name.
Yeah, Scots people write in.
I think it's just for pizza. It's not like a generic anything deep fried is something crunch.
Fish crunch.
If listeners are interested to hear a detailed discussion of the deep frying of chocolate bars in Scotland, the episode of the Off Menu podcast with Ian Sterling has a detailed discussion of the form and is thoroughly interesting.
Are the Glaswegians going to write in, or are they just going to be angry at John quietly?
Hi, Meg.
We had a letter from Andy Openshaw, long-time listener, first-time writer, maybe. Said he finds Octothorpe really helpful to get insight, which seems strange to me, but there we go. And he's coming to Glasgow, so we will see you there, Andy. He said, based on our recommendations, he has started watching For All Mankind, and he observes its similarities to Mary Robinette Cowell's The Lady Astronaut series. I don't think it's that as similar as all that, but yes, I think he says the similarities are evident, and was one inspired by the other? And I think many people have talked about this on the internet who know a lot more about it than we do, Andy. And do you think the existence of For All Mankind might prevent a TV film adaptation of The Lady Astronaut from happening? You can never tell, really, because sometimes books that are like each other make it more likely that adaptations happen, and sometimes they make it less likely. That wasn't very profound. And said one of the great positives of the book is the inclusion of a trans character, and appreciated that about The Adventures of Amina al-Sarafi, which I have not read yet.
Yet.
But we'll be reading soon, ready for our Hugo episode, which has become a tradition now, I think.
Andy asks whether or not there are other examples of historical SFF that have sort of foregrounded trans people in. I confess I do not read much historical SF. I mostly read the SF with lasers in. So if anyone does and has any recommendations, please write in and we will convey them to Andy.
Finally, the only other Hugo novel he's read yet is Some Desperate Glory by Emily Tesh. And he thinks it's fab and has wonders if any of the Octothorpes have read it, and if so, what do you think? And I would refer you back to the episode where I picked it, which is...
And obviously you have used the spreadsheet to work out what episode that was, because you saw that coming and thought, I need the episode number.
Well, no.
All right. So, fun fact, as Alison says, Liz picked it in episode 100. Because Alison picked The Coral Bones that episode, not Some Desperate Glory.
I read it after Liz picked it, bollock.
Yes. I am the trendsetter here. You have mentally decided you picked it because you liked it.
I did like it. Good.
We will come back to the Hugo finalists in a future episode before the voting deadline so that we can tell everyone what we thought.
I will note that For All Mankind failed to get on the Hugo ballot this year, which I think... I didn't like the series very much, so I can't really argue with it, but I think it probably got knocked off because there's several Doctor Who's and Strange New Worlds on there.
Yeah, no. I think when we discussed this in our nominations episode, you said you didn't like For All Mankind season 4, and I was like, oh, I can see that it might not be quite as sharp as season 3, but I think I feel like it's setting things up for a season 5 that might not happen, so, you know.
No, it will happen. They announced that season 5 and a spin-off. Did you see?
A spin-off?
Yeah, Star City, which sounds interesting.
Spin-off of Russia leading up to the Russian moon landing.
Oh, that sounds so good.
It sounds way better. I'm way more excited for that than for season 5 of For All Mankind, to be honest. But
this might just be you going, oh, you loved it when it was kind of alternate history, but now it's like possible future, it's less exciting.
I think it's that. It's not because it's possible future. It's because the characters are no longer as interesting. Because this is the problem with For All Mankind, right? It's trying to basically do a very long time span by keeping in familiar characters. And it just leads to, like, ludicrous situations. And then when they've introduced new characters, I don't think they've been done half as interestingly as the old ones were. So...
And the original character's natural arc has very much come to an end in most cases.
Yeah.
I've not watched season 4, but having been watching season 3, I am genuinely baffled that they are doing a season 5, because it does very much feel like season 3 could be the end of the natural arc of most of those characters, and I don't really understand how you get 2 extra seasons out of it, but we will see.
Yeah, 6 seasons in a movie.
It feels like a role-play campaign that no one really wants to end, but the best days are behind it in a way, coming from a perspective of sheer ignorance, obviously.
We also heard from Christopher J. Garcia. Thank you to Chris. Among other things, he's never heard of Maundy Thursday. We're way back before EasterCon in Chris' letter chronology, by the way. He's never heard of Maundy Thursday before. And he says it's also WrestleMania Thursday. So I do propose that we rename Maundy Thursday to WrestleMania Thursday.
Mm.
He has that in common with Whisper AI, which also does not recognise Maundy Thursday. Ask me how I know. Transcription software.
Does it think it's WrestleMania Thursday, though? Yeah.
It does not change Maundy to WrestleMania. However, I'm going to go and do a global search and replace on previous transcripts, which will now confuse people. When you get that pull request, John.
I'm not accepting that pull request. John, can I have admin rights? Then I can turn down Alison's pull request, please. Chris also points out that transcripts are very useful for historian types because they're very easily searched.
He also says that he is starting to record podcasts again, but in true Garcia standard, he doesn't listen before he publishes. Chris also emailed in on Octothorpe Live.
Shall I do just selected quotes from Chris's email? British people are just weird. Burn down the business meeting. I'm infinitely funnier in my head. And is Telford in San Jose?
Did you explain that last one?
Yeah, the last one is because he says a town full of low to mid-range chain restaurants is Telford in San Jose. I just thought it was funnier to leave out the context.
You were correct, I'm sorry.
I did suggest on Anonymous Claire the Nando's index for EasterCon bids, and I'm sticking by it. A hypothetical Newcastle Gateshead EasterCon venue would have a Nando's index of 4. So this is proof, if needed, that this is just a very good indicator of quality of venue. Heathrow gets 0.
What is going on in Newcastle Gateshead? Why do you have so many Nando's? I thought you would be very high on like the Greggs index, but not the Nando's.
I have already said, surely it has a Greggs index.
Oh, mate, you want to know how many Greggs's are there? Because I tell you the answer to that, there's way more than 4.
You're never more than a 6 foot from a Greggs in Newcastle.
I'm proud. There are also a variety of very lovely restaurants, but it is a big city, and therefore it has Greggs and Nando's in many equal measures. I think the Greggs index would be... 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12. I think it would be 13 walkable. Although some are more walkable than others. Right.
Hope John is now investigating a Newcastle Gateshead bid where we can all go out for a cheeky Nando's.
Raj wrote to us on Mastodon as well. It seems like Blue Sky is for pizza crunch and Mastodon is for serious commentary. I don't know whether that's true. Raj says he enjoyed Nicholas White as Stunt Liz and loved the April Fool's Hugo Trophy, but then says, I do think declining the nomination is a classy move on Biggles Tickler's part, but I'm not really sure how it got nominated in the first place. The whole thing was funny, but I'm not convinced a tweet was worth a best related work nod.
It's just such a weird grab bag category, and I think the more like weird grab bag things get nominated, people think, well, this is a grab bag for anything I liked in fandom last year.
But in previous years, we've had stuff like FireCon and Con's Eland Fringe get nominated, the George R. R. Martin Can Fuck Off Into the Sun essay got nominated, and various other things have been nominated. And certainly over the pandemic, that got more common, it seems to me. And this just seems to be another example of that. I'm very glad that the eventual list of finalists is mostly things I can engage with as art and then work out which is the best, which this is actually the strongest slate, I think, for some time.
I agree with that. I think 2021, it's possible that there were fewer of the serious overarching books that we think are great in this category that you would normally expect published in 2020, and that was the reason for more of the memey things getting on the ballot in 2021.
To the long list.
I think it's just, you know, there are things that people want to celebrate, but I still think of best related work as being like, you know, it's the one place on the Hugo ballot we can celebrate essays and works of criticism and art books, of which there are, you know, a good number of really interesting ones. And so it's a shame to have, like, a tweet that went viral in a very interesting and fun but totally random manner. I don't know. It's, how am I supposed to judge that against an actual, like, retrospective book of critical essays across someone's career?
And fortunately, you don't have to.
Fortunately, I don't have to. So I favour keeping it towards that end of things.
Well, I will say in 2021, FireCon and Con's Eland Fringe pushed Liam McCormack's Biology and Manners essays on Lois McMaster Bejeweled and Burroughs's The Magic of Terry Pratchett off the ballot, both of which I think would have been better presences on the finalist slate than two conventions that were never going to win the award. And indeed, they did not. So, yeah. Because that's the other thing. When voters get their hands on best related work, Alison is right. Like, the memes tend to be unlikely to actually clinch the win. Con's Eland Fringe came below no award in best related in 2021, and FireCon did better. But this year, it seems good.
Yeah, no, it's got some great things on it.
It's a good award. Oh, sorry. It's a good slate. And I'm very glad to see A Traveller in Time, The Critical Practice of Maureen Kincaid Speller on the ballot. But I do wish we had celebrated Maureen Kincaid Speller when she was alive instead of waiting until it was too late.
So one of the nominees for Best Related Work is A Traveller in Time, The Collected Works of Maureen Kincaid Speller. And unfortunately, obviously, Maureen will not be with us at the time of the Hugo Awards. So I think it is a shame that there was no collection of her work during her lifetime. But maybe this is going to change in future with criticism, because I noticed that Briardine Books, friends of the podcast, have announced their second collection of essays.
That was the exact point I was going to make, which is that the sad thing here is that Maureen's work wasn't collected in her lifetime, despite being eminently suitable for it. And I think had Neil been publishing books, these amazing books, she's obviously one of the people that he'd have looked at to publish.
Yes, but now we can also plug the latest book.
Yeah, so he's publishing Abigail's book, which I think John has copy edited. Is that right, John? Or laid out? Or both?
I typeset.
Typeset.
Yes, it is coming.
Yeah, no, I have pre-ordered it. Oh, we have had a lock in real time. Do you want the real time lock?
Where?
From Meg McDonald.
Oh.
In chat, she says, letter of comment from the Peanut Gallery. I appreciate that you all have suitably dirty laughs. This is presumably an Octothorpe Live.
So presumably you two and Nicholas have dirty laughs and I have a very clean one.
Yes, I mean, I feel like it's that... Because Nicholas does have quite a dirty laugh, in fact.
Well, that's the feedback we are getting from our audience. So is Nicholas regretting being on Octothorpe Live yet? He probably was at the time someone climbed under a table.
I like the use of the word yet, as if it's a foregone conclusion that he will regret it. It's just a matter of when.
I do understand that he has written to the other lovely podcast finalists. Hello, lovely other lovely podcast finalists, if you're listening, offering to go on their podcast.
Oh. That is scrupulously fair of him.
That is very fair.
It's tricky, right? Because, yeah, no, yeah, that is fair. I like that. At the live show, I asked people to write in with their thoughts on the accessibility of the EastCon venue, and I specifically asked DC in a chance encounter in the hallways before that, and DC has very kindly obliged and written us a lock. I will publish the full lock on my website, and I will link it from the show notes, because it'll be good if people can go and read it in its entirety, but I will pick out some key bits and bobs here and we can go through it, and then we will segue seamlessly into wider discussion of the EastCon and the EastCon venue. DC wrote in to say the first thing to say is that there are problems if you're a non-ambulatory wheelchair user. If you need assistance in the toilet or if you need a hoist to transfer, then there are real problems with the venue, and yet this remains one of the best venues, if not the best sort of in total for wheeled users. And then they say deep sigh. And so yeah, DC's perspective is very much this is a flawed venue, this is a venue that has problems, but it is probably the best venue we have been to as an EastCon if you require access in a wheeled conveyance. And then they go into more details about that. So DC says the location of the centre has challenges. It's in quite a hilly area and some of the road and footpath surfaces are uneven. The routes to the centre of Telford and in the other direction to the on-site hotels both involve in places steep gradients, and the route to the on-site hotels is not well illuminated at night. There's a lot of unevenness in the surface. There is at least one curb which is supposed to be dropped and isn't. People have been talking about this in some conversations I've seen, but this does seem to be a recurring feature of the criticisms. Is they did seem to be doing work on the path from the convention centre to the on-site hotels. So I assume that that will improve things, but I don't know.
Some of these factors are relevant to other people as well as people with disabilities. So the fact that the nighttime routes are badly lit is relevant for lots of people, not merely people who are who have mobility issues, and that all of the routes to the none of the hotels are quite on site, so everybody has some walking to do to get to the their accommodation. But again, overall, I thought this venue had a lot going for it for people with a range of needs.
I think it's also Levitation had like an access audit on their website. I think it shows the importance of doing the access audit, not just in your venue, but someone ideally needs to like walk from the station to the venue at night and see if it's got unusual humps on the path or it's unlit or anything like that. And then I guess ideally someone would also go to the site just before the con to see if anyone has moved things around or if there is engineering work or if there is building work or anything like that. Because, yeah, it's not just having an accessible venue, it's whether people can actually get to your accessible venue with any sort of ease.
It was clearly easier for people with mobility issues to be in the attached hotels rather than the budget hotels that were a little way away. They were only about a 5-minute walk, a 10-minute walk late at night. But that might be something that bursary payments are useful for, is bridging that gap for people who do need to be in the more expensive hotels but would otherwise choose the cheaper ones.
Yeah, I think Bradford, because we used to have split hotels for Bradford, and I think there was a process where if you had access needs, you could be guaranteed a room in the main hotel, but I don't know how much help Bradford gave fans with the cost of that.
Well, the same for the Helsinki Worldcon.
We routinely give people access to close hotels, but yes, they're the most expensive ones, and that can be a significant, for Telford it was a significant extra cost because I always stay in the main hotel and I was like, oh, Premier Inn looks good.
I'm just saying it was the same for the Helsinki Worldcon, which has that one hotel attached to the convention centre, which was quite expensive, and everyone else was basically a train ride away. But we did do some work going onto the trains and trams with wheelchair users to see how easy it was to use those to get around and things like that. So then you could recommend, okay, well, if you don't want to stay in that expensive hotel, this hotel is also suitable, and we have tested that there's a step-free route on the trains and things like that.
No, and DC does say jumping towards the end of The Lock. They didn't have a lot of interaction with venue staff, but when they did, it was clear that the staff had had training about how to help people with wheels and especially how not to, which is also better than an average venue in DC's experience. DC talks a little bit about the inside of the venue. So the first unpleasant surprise is that there are slopes in the building, and you can't get to the passenger lift without going up a slope on the ground floor. They're not very steep, but it's a bit of effort that would really be better. And then on the first floor, there's another slope, which is on the first floor, there's another slope, which is worse. It's steeper and carpeted, and DC needed help to get up it every time they tried. They say fans are pretty good at offering help, but it's not good that it's essential. And I know Doug Spencer has said on various places, like, if you need access to be provided, like, on request, then it's not access. I think the thing that, as someone who is not disabled, it's not helpful to say that in a vacuum. Like, if this venue is better than other venues, I assume in other venues you also have to ask for things. And if you have to ask more than this one is still better, even if it's still not perfect. And I guess part of the thing here is, coming back to DC's point, that this is probably, you know, in the top tier of accessibility as far as EastCon venues go. So, like, do bear in mind, listener, that, like, you know, if this sounds awful, this is think about how bad the other places must be, I guess, is the point. Like, think about the challenges that other venues must hold. Telford seemed quite flat to me, with the exception of the hill up to the town, but I don't know why they've put slopes in on the floors. It might have been an unavoidable thing based on where they were building.
I felt one of the things I felt about the venue in terms of access provision was that it was clearly built just before the point where all of this would have been done in quite a different way. And so things like there is no escalator from the ground floor to the first floor, and clearly there ought to be, just staircases. The very small lift, the internal slopes, there are quite a lot of internal places where you had a choice between a fairly steep slope, actually, or steps. And you just think, well, this is all the sort of thing that's been designed out of buildings of this kind in the last 20 years. So I don't know when it got built, but it feels like it was just before we started to take accessibility of this sort of space seriously.
So living in somewhere where access is, I think, a little bit behind the UK and probably where the UK was, you know, 20, 25 years ago, they are in some places putting ramps in, but the ramps are just incredibly steep and I can't see anyone ever being able to self-propel up them. And to be honest, they'd be quite hard to push a lot of people up them. Sometimes ramp is not ramp.
Going to lifts, there's only one passenger lift and there's a goods lift. So the passenger lift is like a problem because obviously if the lift breaks down, goods lift would be the only option. The goods lift was the route people using mobility scooters had to use because the passenger lift was too small. If there were no staff, they had to phone for someone to come and work the lift. I gather this went mostly okay, but sometimes there was a delay and they just had to wait for someone to come. And that is like another clear negative of the site. They do have planning permission for an extension, which would include a second lift, but we don't know what the status of that is. But DC does say, in asterisks, this is not the smallest lift we've had at an EastCon venue. That is worth bearing in mind again.
The Radisson at Heathrow has some tiny lifts. I do remember on a site visit watching someone basically manoeuvre a Moby in there to check you could actually get them in, and it did require a bit of skillful driving. But I don't remember us breaking them at any point, so we probably did quite a skillful job. But they were kind of just big enough, some of the lifts at the back.
Then DZ wraps up by saying they have a lot of detailed thoughts about toilets. Basically saying the toilet provision is not great. They weren't terrible for DC, but for someone significantly less mobile would have much more of a problem. And goes into a lot of detail on that. And notes, I won't go into all the detail, but I will pull out, this is the one aspect in which the TIC seems worse than most other EastCon venues, which is bizarre given the scope of the place. There really needs to be an accessible toilet on each floor, which is twice the size, if not larger, than any of the existing toilets. So that is, I think, as far as I can tell, that's the big criticism DC has of the site, is that the toilet provision is not up to snuff. there were some discussions of accessibility in the lead up to the convention, but I don't think anyone was annoyed about the toilets. But as far as I could tell, the toilets are one of the worst bits. So I did not know that. Thank you, DC.
It's probably very easy to go, oh, there is an accessible toilet, great, and not think about the fact that if you're on a different floor and your only access to the toilet is a goods lift where you have to phone someone to get them to use it, then that's also a big barrier to that.
DC sort of has some generic notes on EastCons, which is basically, if a room has two doors, don't bolt one of the doors shut. That seems like good, coherent advice. Makes sense. And then the other one is, when you have program rooms that are laid out in cabaret style, that can make it a lot harder for wheeled users. And so when you do that, I think we probably need to have someone try and navigate the layout in wheels, like prior to the convention starting, to make sure that it isn't a pain in the ass for someone with wheels. But yes, those are good points as well.
Yeah, I mean, normally when we lay out cabaret style, it's because we're expecting things to have a slightly smaller, you know, an audience who will appreciate that, but as maybe smaller than it would be if you laid it out theatre style. So it should be possible to put a big aisle in there. I'm just saying. I don't think we necessarily say, oh, access requires us to make every seat in that room capable of having a wheelchair at. I'm not a wheeled user and I don't have a lot to add to this. I mean, I think this is something we should take seriously. I do think, as with everything on access, it has to be balanced with the other access needs of the members, that, you know, we know that it's not always possible to accommodate all of the things that everybody needs. We took a view with conversation that we would be quite clear about what we could and could not accommodate as a standard in advance. And then if people needed more than that, we would see what we could do to help.
And so that kind of segues into something. The 2024 committee has said that Telford was the cheapest venue they looked at to run their EastCon in. And I assume that it is true that if we were using a more expensive venue, it would be more modern and it would have less of these problems. And part of this might get into a discussion in the future on a future episode on the expense of holding EastCons. Then you get into a thing of kind of discussing very carefully the implications for wealth privilege in the community. And that is a discussion we will have in the future. If you have any thoughts on that, please do let us know. We've been talking about Telford, listeners. Telford. Telford.
I had never been to Telford, I don't think.
I've been to the KFC in Telford on account of how it's a convenient stopping place when I go cottaging. It turned out the hotel that I had booked for me in Espana and that Neil and Nick then decided to book was opposite that KFC, so I felt right at home.
Telford's fine. Like, you know.
Well, and that's the other thing, transport privilege, right? Where Telford is 3.5 hours away from everywhere, which sounds great until you realise it's not that it's up to 3.5 hours away from everywhere. It is literally 3.5 hours away from everywhere.
It says it's within 3 hours of 90% of the country, and people were like, oh, they don't mean Scotland. But in fact, 90% of the population, I can believe, but it's kind of perfect travel time. Most people, it's going to take longer than 3 hours much of the time. Because it had been telling us, I think, 2 hours, 48 minutes, right up until we left the house on Maundy Thursday.
How did you find travelling to Telford, Liz?
It was good. I just opened up my members portal and I clicked on the link and I could wave at people in the auditorium. In several cases, I WhatsApped them to say, I can see you, which probably did not go down as well as I thought it would have. Yeah, I think people maybe did not realise that the streaming was streaming the panel rooms before the panel opened and they were showing the audience. But it was nice to see people.
Yeah, we did that last year too. I think we might be moving gently into the online bit, but we do want to say a little bit about the members portal, because I have been doing catch-up and the members portal, which was put together by Andrew January and means that you have a kind of seamless integration that means you're logged into the Discord and the Rings Central events and the guide all at once, and you can just carry on watching your catch up without having to continuously reauthenticate or wonder where you left it. It was one link that had links to everything else. It was great. Well done, Andrew.
Yes, I've having done some like online stuff for punctuation, I am a little bit in awe of how much Andrew has done for levitation, and I think he is he has an eye towards trying to make some of this available for other conventions to use. So it is like stuff like having a Discord bot that can authenticate your Discord account and then make sure that you're always in the convention Discord, and building like the members portal, as you said, and all of that is just very it's very impressive stuff.
And it meant that they didn't I was watching the Discord moderators channel, and they did not have to, there were only like a handful of people who had problems getting into the Discord, and everyone else found it smooth, so that's kind of good.
Yeah, it was great. Remember how much time and effort AceCons have had to put into like checking everyone is actually on the members list and cross-checking and making sure everyone can join and making sure no one has two Discord accounts in the wrong name. And it was so smooth, I just clicked on it. I mean, I clicked on it several times because Discord is not that smoothly integrated, but it did work. It's great.
The other thing I really liked about the members portal is it had a link to a tip jar for tipping the TIC staff without needing cash, because I always feel guilty when the hat comes round at the closing ceremony and I haven't got any coins in my pocket because I haven't done for years. So having a place I could like tip without needing any coins was very good.
Yes, that was great. I felt bad for several years. I never managed to be organised enough to have a tip because, yeah, you're never paying cash anymore.
Unfortunately, they closed the tip jar before I thought, when I started to watch the catch-up, oh, there's a tip jar, I should tip, and discovered it's closed already. So next time, guys, have a tip jar that stays open, or probably a second tip jar for people who are doing the catch-up and remembering that they should have tipped, because that would be good. It may just be me, but I bet it's not. So I have been watching the catch-up. This is a convention that, like a cheeky Nando's, has been repeating on me for weeks.
I've never had Nando's repeat on me. How dare you?
Actually, Nando's is lovely. Wouldn't hear a word said again. But I would say younger people have castor iron stomachs than older people, just saying.
KFC now.
Fair enough.
Yeah. So I have watched more EasterCon programme than not merely at any time for the last several years, but possibly for every EasterCon combined. But probably not quite. I used to watch quite a lot of programme at the beginning, but I've watched a lot of programme this year. I'll catch up. I've watched, I think, about 14 or 15 items, which is lots. I'm not counting Octothorpe Live, which I woefully said I was listening to for the fifth time the other day. But I think I am done with it now. Only one of those was optional, I think. The other four were mandatory.
Yeah, because Alison does the transcripts, so has to listen to it to make sure it's okay to go out, and then has to listen to it to edit the transcripts. So
yeah, and then we also listen to it in the car coming. And then I listen to it with somebody at some point. So there we go. Five. A lot. Two.
Wait, you listen to it in the car coming home from EasterCon? Okay.
Listeners cannot see Liz's absolutely baffled face, but take it from me, it's great.
Right, so
I have to force myself to listen to it once to check it's okay, and then I'm like, no, I never want to listen to myself again. So
No, it wasn't me. We worked out that, so one of the things that was good about Ring Central Events is that it would stream the, not all programs do this, but it would stream the audio to the car for CarPlay. And I said, right, so we've got the catch up. What does everyone want to listen to? And there was a chorus of, oh, could we do Octothorpe Live, please? So it wasn't my choice. It was my family. I blame my family.
I mean, I enjoy that they were listening to it on catch up because they did not come to your program item.
Stephen did come to the programme item, but I don't think Marianne and Jonathan did.
Marianne and Jonathan didn't come to the programme item, and Stephen, I sent Stephen to run some errands because we were trying to sort out the newsletter, I think, at the same time.
Yeah.
So I don't really know what to watch on catch-up because Levitation has not shared the catch-up stats. And I mean, this is a choice, but in the same way that there was a point where Nicholas said last time that the Hugos belong to the voters, I feel like the EasterCon belongs to its membership, and it's clearly useful information for members to know what things are getting views on catch-up, in the same way that they can see what programme items are busy when they go into a programme room. And I think that conventions should release the catch-up stats. A take.
I mean, I think... I agree. I think it's a philosophical point for me.
So, Alison, when you're trying to pick what programme item to watch live, do you go into all the programme rooms and see which one has the most people in and go and sit in that one?
Sorry, I feel like you suggested that I might choose to watch a programme item live that I'm not actually on or required to be at.
Yeah, no, I'm just making the analogy. If you're saying, you know, you should have the stats, like you can see how many people in a room, is that how you actually pick programme? And I can also see the view that if you are on an item and the catch-up shows that basically no one has watched it, then that could be quite demoralising. Just like if you're on a programme item and two people come to watch it, except then the stats are there for everyone to see. So I can see the argument against.
No, I'm doing a little bit of, but actually, if we're going to have conversations, I know that they've got the data and they've got the data on people in rooms as well. If we're going to have conversations about what sorts of things should we be programming, in particular, what sorts of things we should be programming when, because one of the things about the convention is that they programmed a lot of very serious panels really late in the evening, and they programmed quite a lot of lighthearted stuff at 10 o'clock in the morning, and I would like to see more thought to when people are likely to want that sort of thing. So, and this sort of data is useful. I just like data, really. That's the thing.
I mean, I like data, obviously. But I think there is a philosophical argument here, which is how much weight should we put on what people want to watch by how much they watch on catch-up, and how much weight should we give to what people watch when they are actually physically at the convention, or indeed watching not on catch-up, but live streaming from the con? Because they'll kind of give you an idea. Like, do you... If you put something serious on very late at night and no one actually goes to the room physically, but a bunch of people then watch it on catch-up later, it probably still wasn't the right decision to put it on at that time.
Also, I note that if I go to the Conversation website, there's no stats on programme watching on there either. So
no. What we did last year was release a kind of greatest hits. We released the top ones, which I think is a compromise here. So the must-not-miss items.
Yeah, I can see that.
It would be interesting to see kind of how they compare to, you know, things watched on site versus things that were streamed, and certainly, like, do more people stream science programme? Is there bits of programme that no one ever wants to stream? Because that all might also be, if you need to choose how many items you're able to stream, then you can pick which one people are less likely to watch and not stream it, that kind of thing.
Yeah,
I haven't seen the conversation list of top ones, though. I would like to see that.
I think some of the information is being shared with Glasgow, which I think will be quite useful, because I think they do have these counts. They know how many people streamed live and how many people were in the room and how many people are watching on catch-up. And I think this is quite useful, interesting data for programme teams.
Yarp.
Yeah, so I just had to guess, and this is part of our kind of general argument. I have in general enjoyed the talks more than the panels. I would observe that most of the 157 items on catch-up are talks or panels. There's not a lot of alternate things. There are a few, but there aren't all that many.
I think it's worth noting that the room where a lot of the items that were happening that were not really talks or panels was not being streamed.
Also, if one person, a five-person panel, doesn't want to put on catch-up, then it's not on catch-up, whereas for talks, only one person has to agree for it to be on catch-up.
I think we're now at the point where it would not be unreasonable to say that unless you've got something absolutely amazing you can put on the programme, but with a person who won't let it be streamed or catched up, then I think that's okay. But for everything else, the rule should be if you want to be on the programme, you're going to be on streaming and catch-up.
I think my opinion on that is dictated a little bit by percentages of how many people actually opt out.
Very few.
Because if, like, only... Yeah, like, because my impression of it is that it's less than 1% of people actually have a problem with it. And so, yes, I think that's probably fair. But if it was, like, 25%, I'd be like, well, no. And that gets tricky. I mean, I guess my worry is if the percentage is high enough that you suspect it might be acting to remove diverse voices from program, I'd probably think it was problematic. But I don't think it actually would do that. So I think it would be fine. I would be paying attention to whether or not I thought my opinion on that was changing, I guess, is. But it's an interesting, it's definitely an interesting sort of thing to talk about. And also, I think obviously the benefit to widening participation in the people who can actually engage with the program probably acts in such a positive way in terms of diverse voices that that probably outweighs any penalty. I'm not sure.
Yeah, I would say conversely, the number of people opting out, I think, is small enough that you don't bother about it. We just have a handful of things that aren't streamed. That's okay. Or rather, I think a lot of things there are, in this case, it's not that they weren't streamed. I think it's that they were streamed, but then not available on catch up in some cases. So you had to watch them live. And I think that's fine. How was the bar, though? Did everyone just go to bed when the bar closed?
No. No, it worked really well.
It was great. I have a whole thing about this. I have a theory. So, Liz, it was amazing. I think it might have been the best EasterCon bar I've ever been to. And I have a theory as to why. Which was, basically, what would happen was everyone would be sitting in the TIC and they'd be having a bevy. And there was some real ale until we drank it all. And then, like, come 10:30 or 11:30, depending on the night, we all had to go over to the Holiday Inn. And that was really good because it took everyone who had been sitting where they were sitting through the evening and it jumbled everyone up. And you saw people you hadn't noticed were in the bar and you got into new groups. And then you went to the Holiday Inn, you sat down in different groups and you had entirely new conversations with different people. And it was so dynamic and great. And I have no idea if it would scale with higher membership numbers because the Holiday Inn is a finite space. But the International Hotels bar was almost empty, so I don't know whether we'd just be able to sort of spread out. I will say the beers in the hotels were fine to pour, but that was also quite good because it meant after I'd had sort of 15 beers by 11, I could just switch to tap water, and then when I got to bed I was only mildly pissed instead of utterly stinking. So yes, I thought it was good.
The Holiday Inn were also pretty nice to us. They clearly have very great experience of people turning up after they've been kicked out of the TIC. That is clearly their entire business model. And unlike some hotels that are in that position, they just basically were there. They were very happy to sell beer to a lot of different people. And it was comfortable space. I think, yes, a larger EasterCon would have had to use both the bars, the bar in the International as well as the bar in the Hilton. They stopped serving kind of two-ish. It was fine. It was good. What was your, because my theory about the real ale was that they bought the right amount and it sold out, and that's what should happen. Because it sold out about 7 or 6 o'clock on the Sunday, which is about what you want.
I thought they probably needed a little bit more real ale. I agree with you that selling out of the real ale on the Sunday is probably desirable, but I was a little bit grumpy that they sold out of all the nice real ale on the Saturday, and I feel that is a bit early. Salopian Brewery is fine, and it's the local brewery, so I think having the local brewery is good, but they don't necessarily have the range of beers I enjoy as much. Claire Brierley, on the other hand, did, and then I was quite drunk, and I blame Claire Brierley. Okay.
Oh, that night when we just locked ourselves in the newsletter room and drank beer very rapidly for some time.
Until all the lights went out, Liz, and then we were like, oh, we should probably go to the Holiday Inn now.
Did you almost get locked in the newsletter room over light? That'd be quite funny.
I was so pissed. That was the night that I basically, I got very maudlin in the Holiday Inn and moaned at people and totally, because I believe I'm quite a cheerful drunk. So being a miserable drunk was very bad.
I think you're an intense drunk.
I think you've definitely been a slightly maudlin drunk at me at EasterCons, I'm afraid.
Really sorry.
It's probably like in this like post-COVID era when everyone was a little bit more, you know, intense.
I would quite like the bar to be slightly more comfortable. I mean, not the bar in the Holiday Inn, which was fine. The bar in the Salford International Centre. I like proper chairs. But I mean, any chairs are better than no chairs. So, you know.
Yeah, and wasn't there a big faff at Longcon that like convention centres are not filled with like a big abundance of comfy chairs for bars?
Yeah, they were the same chairs that we had at Longcon in the bar area, but we had a lot of different seating options in that big fan village space. So
I think I do wonder whether a larger EasterCon would have been able to put more budget towards having some comfier spaces, but I think that's the sort of thing that is fixable but might be tricky.
What was the membership, by the way? I maybe didn't read all the newsletters.
On site was something like 450.
Yeah, it's a really good size.
Oh, so quite... But quite small as EasterCons go.
Yeah, very small for an EasterCon. There are numerous venues that we don't look at because they're too small for an EasterCon that you could have put that EasterCon in practice because it ended up smaller than we expected.
Yeah. How did you find the social side of things, Liz? Online? Or not really?
I didn't really do anything.
Cool.
This was because I did not time shift, so functionally I was going to bed at, you know, 6 p.m. before anyone was really into party time. But I also don't think there was much arranged. It was just I could join a Discord voice channel, and I am not the sort of person to randomly join Discord voice channels while sitting at home and doing that.
If you want social events on your Discord or or online spaces, you have to actually have somebody whose job it is to make those things happen. It's quite a lot of work. It's not something I could do whilst actually going to a convention. If I ever find I cannot go to conventions because of injury or illness, I will definitely volunteer for that job. If I ever test positive for COVID on Maundy Thursday, I will spend my weekend sorting out online spaces at the EasterCon.
I mean, I did feel that the virtual provision was good and they had Discord channels to chat in, and I happily watched items and chatted on Discord with people who were in the room, and that was all very nice. And so I felt the virtual option was quite reasonably priced for what I got. But if I wanted like a full social con experience, it wasn't really that. On the plus side, no one called me drunkenly from the com, so I am winning there.
I mean, I will drunkenly call you later.
Thank you, John.
We kind of texted you during the panel, though, didn't we?
I think I messaged John with some jokes.
That didn't go in the pod?
Nope.
No, but you did not at any point. You have in the past, for example, phoned me up from a con at like 6 a.m. So 6 a.m. my time, I should say.
We're great friends.
Yeah.
And it was nice, but also no. So I'm viewing it as a plus that no one WhatsApped me at 6 a.m.
Well, there was probably a good reason, right? There was a good reason. And we planned it.
We did. I still regretted it.
Yeah, so if anyone wants the jokes that we edited out of the, or that John edited out of the live version of Octothorpe, if you're an EasterCon member, it's still available in its unexpurgated form on Catch Up.
Yes.
So go watch it there. For another couple of weeks.
I've watched some Catch Up, but I need to watch more.
About 10 days by the time you're actually listening to this. So, yeah, get move on.
Yeah. Do it now. Now. Stop what you're doing. Pull over. Watch the programme.
Do we want to recommend any particular items that people should watch, or...
Can I do ones that I watched in person?
Yeah.
Or is that cheating?
That's okay. Like, you would have watched them on Catch Up, but you'd already seen them, so that's fine. I can recommend ones that I watched when they were streamed live, so yeah.
If I'm just going to recommend one of the ones I've watched so far, it would be Esther McCallum Stewart on the history of the board game of board games and how it relates to Doctor Who. That is not the title. I thought that was a great talk. I really enjoyed it. And it also has lots of slides of Shuta Gatwa. So, you know, that's good.
I enjoyed watching John Clute's BSFA lecture, which is about a subject I knew nothing about, namely the fact that the British Library has been discarding book jackets for many years. And he had some really interesting examples of where the book jackets are very, like, historically important to the presentation and marketing of the book. And that we wouldn't know any of this except that some people have saved the books with the book jackets. So I recommend that.
I have been thinking about that talk ever since watching it, because, as in passing, he said that the British Library now accepts an electronic deposit as a deposit of a book. And electronic books often do not have all the front matter that a book would have. And I wonder if we are losing critical things by... as a result of this policy, but also I wonder whether electronic books should have all of the stuff that a paper book has as part of its front matter and back matter.
Esther's talk was called Good Men Don't Need Rules, Games, Play and Doctor Who.
I mean, I'm probably going to slightly spoil this talk by saying her argument was that good men bend the rules and bad men and villains cheat.
Yes. I was going to recommend a panel I saw, but unfortunately I don't think it was streamed. So I'm going to recommend the same one that I've been recommending all along, which is Strange Worlds, Strange Games, which was Stuart Hodgson's talk, which I thought was very good. You can see me wearing my Garth Marenghi cosplay in the stream, but it was very interesting. And I think the other one, I'd tell you to watch the business meeting if you're interested in EasterCons and you weren't there, because there was stuff about the next EasterCon, which was also interesting.
I thought the panel that John was on about mega constellations was really excellent, and you should go watch that.
I met Bill Ray. He's very interesting. Hello, Bill, if you're listening.
I met Bill Ray at Lisa Conrad's 60th birthday party, and we had a conversation during which it became clear that he had run the games room for the EasterCon I chaired in 1995. And I mean, I did know that at the time, but 1995 is a long time ago, and I can tell you Bill looked very different in 1995. And I did not recognise him, and it took us some time to work this out, and he did not recognise me either.
On the subject of games, this EasterCon, I spent more in the dealer's room than I have at many EasterCons, because this EasterCon did something very clever. They had a stall that sold games. And so I bought games, and it was good.
I feel like it was the games company that did something very clever by taking stalls at the Eastercon. But did Eastercon reach out to them?
I don't know. I just think, I remember at my second Eastercon, there was a game stall at Heathrow in 2008, and I remember buying a copy of a Star Wars RPG supplement from them and being very happy I'd found it. And ever since then, I've been surprised by how many science fiction conventions don't have games stalls. I am always confused by this, because if you want to part me from my money, I have games in the dealer's room. But they did, and it was good. I bought a copy of Cyborg, which I'm very much looking forward to playing. And I also bought a copy of Lucky for None, which came with a D13, which I'm very excited about.
Chris Lowry, who was representing Beyond Cataclysm Games at Eastercon and ran that stall, was very good value generally, in that he was on a panel that I was on, an interesting... It went through numerous changes before the event, because Chris came along and said, well, this is a panel about games journalism and I'm a games journalist, so maybe I should be on it. And it took a little time, but we did actually manage to get him onto the panel.
Yes.
In the end. But also, he played games with me. I had to play a game every day. I am playing a different game every day in 2024, which is quite a strange way to behave, but there you go. And Chris helped me by playing Coup with me at Eastercon.
And me. I was there too.
Yeah, but you're not trying to play a different game every day in 2024, which is the mad thing.
No, but I still count as a person in your anecdotes, Alison.
Sometimes.
Boo. Boo.
Depends. Yeah, so no, he was good. He was good fun to hang out with, and good fun on and good value on panels, and yeah.
Yes, I think that tabletop games panel was interesting, but that's mostly because I like games. If you like games, you might also find it interesting. If you don't, it's unlikely.
Yes, I'm quite blessed in that a couple of people have said the panels that I was on were interesting, so that was quite nice. We didn't have any reports of COVID over the weekend, and that is partly because the venue was extremely spacious, that there was plenty of room for everyone. It's also because we understand that the ventilation system doesn't recirculate any of the air. The air comes in, is used once and goes out again. And they believe that that reduces infection in the building. Sandra Bond commented, so it comes in once and then goes straight back out again. You mean like Dave McCarty?
That is very good. There are no reports of COVID from the con. I got a bit of a tickly cough, but I tested like 7 times and it was negative every time.
I had a pretty bad cough and 2 days of fatigue, but I probably have had 2 days of fatigue anyway.
It felt much more like traditional con crud than it did anything else. There was no COVID. Might be because of the good ventilation, might be because of lower rates. Impossible to tell, but hurrah.
Pretty much, yeah.
Okay.
It's belt and braces. If you don't know you need the braces till the belt falls off.
Yes.
Something like that.
Do we have anything else to say about EasterCon? Oh, we did the newsletter. We should say that. You could go and read it on eFanzines, probably. We'll put a link up when it comes up, which might not quite be by Thursday.
Shall we move on to picks?
I have started but not finished watching the new Amazon Prime series Fallout, which is based on a video game. I have only played, I think, the first and maybe second Fallout to any degree. I really, really liked the first one when it was isometric, but then it went first person and I get lost in first person games because they're like real life and I get lost in real life. But in real life, people don't keep shooting at you. The thing about Fallout, the video game series, is that it is set in a really strange retro future, as if the world had got stuck in corny 1950s America, and then everywhere got nuked, and a bunch of people went and hid underground for 200 years, and now they are, one of them is coming out and having a look at society, and what's been left on the surface. And the TV series captures all of that pretty well, I think. So it doesn't feel realistic in maybe the way that The Last of Us did. It's clearly quite arch all of the time, and that's quite unsettling in a television series in a way that less so in a game. And I am enjoying it a whole lot. I like being the first person to watch something for a while. It is on Amazon Prime, and Amazon Prime is now annoying in Britain because they have started putting little ads in everywhere, and that's pissy and I might have to spend £2.99 a month to get rid of the ads, but that kind of is very annoying. So I don't want to.
I have not watched it yet. It is on the list. Hispania loves the Fallout games. I don't like them very much, but I'm hoping I'll like the TV show.
I played a bunch of Fallout 3. I quite enjoyed it. I haven't watched the TV show yet.
I think we had Fallout 4.
Yeah, so my pick is that I haven't read as much because they released a new patch for Stardew Valley, and then I realised I hadn't played the old patch, and I can now get it on my Switch, which the controls are a lot better than they are on the Android phone, and so I have been farming. It's very nice. It's very relaxing, apart from when you're in the mines. If anyone's not played Stardew Valley, it is a farming simulator, sort of. It's farming simulator, and you're in a village, and you go make friends with all the villagers, in my case, by giving them a present of jam every time I see them. And you're just kind of collecting more and more, you know, materials and metals and vegetables and farming cows and so on, so you can get more money to buy even more vegetables, and then you get a nicer house. And yeah, it's very addictive, really. And each day takes like 12 minutes or something to play. So you can just think, oh, I'll just play through like one day of farming sim, and then it's 3 days later of real time, obviously.
That makes sense. That sounds good. I have not played it. In the same genre as Harvest Moon, I believe.
Yeah, it's got the cute little 8-bit graphics.
I bounced off this game quite hard, but lots of people I know like it quite a lot.
I mean, that might be good for you, because I think you would play it a lot.
Well, I mean, I have tried, and I would love, I love nothing more than to find a new game that I fall into and play obsessively for a while, but the outcomes aren't sharp enough for me. It's too, you've got a whole set of options that you could do every day and they're all a bit fluffy.
Is that because there are sheep in it? I am going to pick a game. I'm going to pick Thunder Road Vendetta.
Sounds very dramatic.
It is. It's basically Mad Max Fury Road, but a board game, except without the character-based drama and with helicopters. So basically, this is a race game in which you are racing along a big desert, and there's a road, and you've got three cars each, and you roll some dice, and you have to put dice on the cars, and the dice you put on the car tells you how fast the car goes, and you can slam other cars and shoot other cars and etc. And it's good. I played it with three friends. It was quite quick. It was quite strategic. And it was just a fun little dice game that oozes theme. And I thought, yeah, it was quite good after we played it. And then my friend showed me the expansion and some of the characters in the expansion. And I was like, oh, I want to play as those characters now, please. So I am excited to play again, which I think is a good sign. Not sure if I need it in my collection, but it's the sort of thing I'm quite happy to play with pals. And that was the Octothorpe podcast. And it's goodbye from me.
It's goodbye from me.
And it's goodbye from me.
So, you're young people, right?
Vaguely.
Do you send people long, incoherent voicemails instead of text messages?
No, but people send me voicemails instead of messages.
Because my daughter did this for the first time last week, and I was like, oh no, this is not an improvement. This is a thing that young people do.
I think I actually quite like it because because I listen to podcasts.
It's just like getting a podcast from your daughter. Or, I mean, not your daughter, but, you know, people.
Yeah. Bed. Like, when my friend Bella sends me, like, loads of voicemails, I just put them on WhatsApp and just, like, you know, do the ironing or something. It's nice.
I will do it occasionally, but if you send me one at a time when it's not convenient to listen to a voicemail message, I will send you a grumpy text message back saying, please put message in text, not listening. I can see their usefulness if you're going to type a really long message. Yeah, fair enough.
In this case, she was telling me a delicious anecdote, and it was much better as an anecdote, such as you might tell someone.
The theme music for this episode was Fanfare for Space by Kevin MacLeod and Compitech.com, used under a Creative Commons Attribution 4.0 license.
This podcast will end at the beep.
Beep.